You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of May 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, broadcasting live from Studio One here in London. I'm Emma Nelson. Coming up in the next hour, more saber-rattling in the South China Sea. We get the latest on that standoff between China and the Philippines. Also on the programme, talk about Mad Men. We assess the real value of the $250,000 music clip. We'll also find out what's happening in the world of design.
Georgian hospitality, which is something that I'd heard about before but had never experienced, it really is one of the country's biggest selling points. It's got an incredible sort of service-orientated culture.
And we have advice for anyone considering a career turning tricks. We'll have theory and practical tips in the last half hour of the programme. All that plus the odd song or two coming up on Midori House. So an action-packed 60 minutes ahead of us. Before that, though, let's get the latest world headlines from Jonathan Wheatley.
Monocle 24 News. The former News of the World editor, Andy Coulson, has today denied he was hired as British Prime Minister David Cameron's media chief because of his ties to News International. Appearing before the Leveson inquiry, Coulson admitted to the inquiry that he had no formal interview.
In truth, it didn't feel like an interview at all. I think it was clear from the off that they were interested in hiring me. You know, the fact that I work on the News of the World, and maybe we discussed some individuals in that regard. I don't really remember, but I'm sure that the conversation would have touched on, you know, my previous employers in some way.
A lawyer for Yulia Tymoshenko and her daughter Yevgenia have said today that they've been refused access to the jailed former Ukrainian prime minister, who is receiving treatment at a hospital in Kharkiv. They said they were given no reason for being refused access to her. The United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has today strongly condemned two suicide car bombings in Syria and called on all sides to cease armed violence and distance themselves from indiscriminate bombings and other terrorist attacks. Two suicide car bombers killed 55 people and wounded 372 in Damascus earlier today, Syrian state media said, in the deadliest attacks in the Syrian capital since an uprising against President Bashar al-Assad began 14 months ago. European lawmakers have today approved a reform on mobile roaming fees. Starting on the 1st of July, charges on calls made while travelling in other European Union countries will no longer exceed 29 cents per minute, and calls received while abroad should cost no more than 8 cents per minute. The Commission Vice President, Neelie Kroes, initiated the new legislation.
Normally spoken, for a family, it will make a difference when they're going on summer holiday of 200 euros this year already. And for businesses, it makes a difference for talking about 1,000 euros on an annual base.
A Briton, Jermaine Grant, has appeared in a Kenya court today, accused of links with Somalia's Islamic militants and possessing explosive material with intent to terrorism. Grant and others are also accused of robbing four police officers of their loaded rifles at a police post in Wajir, near the border between Kenya and Somalia. The American actor Brad Pitt is to become the new pretty face of Chanel No. 5. Normally a symbol of feminine sensuality, embodied by the likes of Marilyn Monroe, Catherine Deneuve and Nicole Kidman, Chanel No. 5 will be represented by a star with designer stubble, a muscular body and a virile reputation. The former model for Levi Jeans shot to stardom when he won a role in the cult film Thelma and Louise, which included a steamy scene where he stripped off to impress Thelma, played by Gina Davis. And finally, staying with pretty faces, a girl called Florence Colgate has won the title of Britain's most natural beauty after she sent a photograph to a television show. According to the judges, she has the kind of beauty many women are prepared to pay a lot of money for: a perfectly symmetrical face, large eyes, full lips and high cheekbones. She explained how she won.
It was just about, like, natural beauty, and I had to send in a picture just wearing, like, no makeup. And from that, I got called saying I got through into the top 5 out of 8,000 people. It's just unbelievable. I honestly did not expect to get this far at all.
Well done, Florence. And those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Jonathan Wheatley there, Monocle's own very natural beauty. The time is 5 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House.
The head at Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljavat, Monocle 24.
Essa è Monocle 24.
Detta è Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Monocle 24
this. This is Monocle 24.
Αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back. Recent events have turned bubbling tensions between China and the Philippines into something arguably much more hostile. For months, the two countries have been engaged in a standoff in disputed waters near the Scarborough Shoal in the South China Sea. Beijing has become more assertive in its claim on this area of the sea. Manila has gone and told China to settle the issue at tribunal. But now China has banned its citizens from taking holiday tours in the Philippines. Well, joining us now to assess this latest event and others on the line is Dr. Alessio Patalano, who's a lecturer in war studies at King's College London. A very warm welcome to Midori House, Alessio. Just to start off with, I have a copy of the Manila Times in front of me, which says, prepare for war, should they?
I think, obviously, if you were sitting in Manila at this particular point in time, I would be worried. But should they really prepare for war? No, I think there is an option there for further diplomatic negotiations. Of course, the standoff has been ongoing for about 4 weeks now, but also a couple of days ago it was reported that the military vessels that were placed in the air are actually disengaged. So I think on the ground at the moment we're looking at a progressive de-escalation. The political question, on the other hand, is still very much open.
You mentioned they should return to diplomatic negotiations. How do you suggest that they go about doing this?
Well, of course, the situation in around the shore, and in particular the question of sovereignty over this particular few rocks and corals, it's a problem that it's not just about China and the Philippines. Taiwan has been also very vocal over the past few days, and in a way, Taiwanese and Chinese claims in the South China Sea overlap. But the problem between the Philippines and China in this particular instance is part of a much bigger problem about a series of contested areas all across the South China Sea, which bring about Malaysia, Brunei, Vietnam, China, the Philippines and Taiwan.
Well, mentioning these additional countries in, you know, being dragged into the whole disputed area, there's a July deadline for an agreement on a code of conduct in the sea between China and Southeast Asian nations. Do you think this agreement will happen? And will it be worth the paper it's written on?
The DOC, the Declaration of Conduct that was originally signed in 2002, was living a very positive moment up until 2008. Then slowly tensions started rising again up until last year, July 2011, when there was a new moment when, after a series of tensions among the different contestants, they all came together and they decided to set a new deadline over this year, up until this year, July, when ASEAN countries will meet again with China to discuss the subject in order to make improvements. The basic logic being to agree on the general disagreement, but try at the same time to find opportunities to cooperate in order to manage the maritime space in a slightly more concerted fashion, sort of all together, so to speak.
Well, let's return to this latest development. The Chinese travel agencies have suspended tours to the Philippines. I mean, how serious a blow is this? I mean, it doesn't strike me as a particularly aggressive form of saber-rattling.
Exactly. I think at the moment what we're looking at is, I was reading the media reporting, there's a tendency in China at the moment to encourage tourists to visit the Philippines. I think it is also a sign of the fact that these issues in all these countries have a strong, very grassroots emotional component to them. So in all these spats, there is always an element of how a domestic element, how the different countries go back to their own domestic nations and talk to their own people and say, like, well, look, you know, as a state actor, I'm actually supporting our sovereign rights. So there is a sense of how this tensions are connected. They are about sovereignty at sea as much as they are about the relationship between the political bodies and the nation in a wider sense.
When you talk about sort of exercising your sovereign rights, China is planning to hold a demonstration in Manila, while at the same time accusing the Philippines of encouraging their citizens to rise up against China. Is this a common practice in two disagreeing nations, that they encourage their citizens to demonstrate in the other country's streets?
I think the situation is one in which, there is an element of, there's two different questions, I suppose, here. On the one hand, making sure that what has been reported in a wider sense across media networks is actually corresponds to a proactive engagement on behalf of, you know, state institutions promoted that kind of expression. On the other hand, I think that the second component of this issue really is related more to the visceral element of the meaning that ascertaining sovereign rights over a specific part of the territory, whether at sea or on land, has to do with the identity, with questions of power and international status. After all, one always has to bear in mind that there is a substantial difference in terms of sheer material power between a country like China and a country like the Philippines. One thing, actually, that characterizes most of these disputes in the South China Sea is the sheer difference of power and of material resources that China can deploy as opposed to countries like Brunei, Malaysia, Philippines, and all the ASEAN countries that are involved in the disputes.
How big is China's marine capacity?
Excuse me, I couldn't hear you very well.
How big is China's marine capacity?
Well, I mean, in terms of sheer military capabilities, I mean, first of all, one must point out that the organizations that in China are involved into different elements of management and security at sea is not just the Navy. That's the Navy and other list five constabulary forces that contribute to the surveillance of fishery activities and the proper management of Chinese maritime space. And of course, you know, if you combine all these elements together, they physically are outnumbered in all sorts of departments, any sort of equivalent in other Southeast Asian countries. Even the Philippines, when they deployed their main naval vessel in Scarborough Shoal at the beginning, when the tension this last month started heating up, this was one of the main assets of the Philippine, the fleet in the Philippines, but draws upon sort of an older U.S. Coast Guard cutter. So we're talking about a vessel that has relatively limited military capabilities.
How much of this do you think has actually been tied into the increased presence in this area of the U.S. military, which has seen a very big push towards that area in the last 6 or 7 months?
I think this is a very important question. In fact, the increased presence of the United States and in general, the change of posture that was heralded with the November 2011 foreign policy paper by Hillary Clinton about how the United States is going to be refocusing its attention in the wider Asia-Pacific. And then if you add to that the decision to deploy Marines in Australia to position the new LCS, the littoral combat ships in Singapore, and then to close, to increase and enhance military cooperation with countries like the Philippines and even Vietnam. All this speaks volume of a substantial perceived change, at least at the Chinese end, in terms of the United States projection into the area.
You talk about a perceived change, and it leads me to my final question, that if push does come to shove, would the United States come to the Philippines' aid?
Well, I mean, at the very least, there is the 1951 security agreement by which the United States are bound to defend the Philippines. But I think at the same time that the very existence of this agreement is a very strong reason for both the Philippines and China to try to avoid any major clash from happening at all costs. Because the repercussions, of course, of any major serious confrontation would be, would have repercussions far reaching beyond the question of establishing sovereignty about the shore. So altogether, I think at the moment what we're looking at is a situation where the maritime space, which is contested in the South China Sea because of the long historical circumstances. At the same time, I'm actually quite positive because over 3 weeks, these ships were facing each other, but at the same time, diplomatic negotiations went on. This means that there is a willingness to keep things under control and to prevent them from escalating a step too far.
Alessio, thank you very much indeed. That was Dr. Alessio Pasolano, who's lecturer in war studies at King's College in London. The time is 16 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House. Stay with us because coming up, we'll be getting the latest from the world of design and paying tribute to the political side of the late hairdresser Vidal Sassoon. Time now then on Midori House to find out what's caught the eye of our design editor this week. Earlier on Thursday, our news editor reached Hugo MacDonald in Tbilisi in Georgia, and this is what he had to say.
Well, I'm in Tbilisi to do a big story for our July-August quality of life issue, and Tbilisi doesn't have a great quality of life track record. It's more to investigate what's happening in the city because it's going through quite a huge amount of change at the moment. Saakashvili, who's the president, has pushed through an enormous amount of reforms in record amount of time, including everything from eliminating crime almost totally to making sure that the whole country has internet access and education reforms, reforms of the judicial system. When he came to power 8 years ago, he wiped out all public offices, which obviously didn't make many people in the country particularly happy, but in 8 years he's sort of managed to build it up and really sort of pushes the country forward into the 21st century.
Can we take it then that sort of the people who live in Tbilisi are delighted with his performance, and across the nation, is there a sense of sort of civic pride, or is there still some underlying scepticism? I know his regime has a fairly sort of checkered record.
Exactly. It's sort of opinion tends to be divided, as you might expect. Young people think that he's the best thing since sliced bread. The older people feel that his very young government, and everybody tends to be in their 30s and 40s, have sort of really ruined the country. And it depends very much who you talk to. Some people think that this is sort of a good thing, that it's progress, and it's all sort of a step forward away from sort of Soviet-era Georgia. But, you know, all these huge changes come at a cost. And there's presidential elections next year, there's parliamentary elections this year. People are a little bit worried that all the progress in the country is wrapped up in this one man and his amazing PR appeal that he has both on home turf and abroad.
I just wonder whether economically the country is also feeling a sense of uncertainty. I mean, I know that the World Bank lauded Georgia for its economic reforms. Is there a sense that the progress there is filtering down to the public and to businesses on an everyday level?
Well, it's interesting. There's not a huge amount of support for sort of enterprises, small independent businesses. The people who are very pro-government, the people who tend to benefit in some way from the government financially and in terms of sort of business and ease of being able to do business with foreign companies. After the 2008 war, a lot of foreign investment just dropped out of the country. And although sort of GDP is increasing, it's about 7% a year, which is still very impressive. It's nothing like the situation that it was before 2008, where foreign investment was really quite enormous and it, like Georgia, was going to be the big success story in the region. That said, you know, there is still a lot of foreign companies that are interested in doing business here, and I think Saakashvili's main goal has been to make the business environment as easy and as smooth as possible as it is for foreigners to come and do business here. But it has no natural resources of its own apart from hazelnuts, seemingly, and a little bit of manganese. That's not enough really for sort of long-term sort of manufacturing or really to sort of export anything that will mean that the economy has sort of long-term stability. What they're really focusing on at the moment is tourism, and that sort of plays very well into Georgian hospitality, which is what everybody talks about here the whole time. But tourism, again, is sort of, it's quite a good thing to tide your economy over for a short term. I'm not sure if it's really going to be the most sound card to build long-term prosperity for the country on.
In that case, I mean, on the ground then, the sort of small businesses, maybe there's not that fertile an environment for them. Is there a sense of where Georgia is looking to sort of attract that new investment? Are they looking to the sort of new emerging global markets, you know, in South America and to the Far East? Or is there a sense that, I imagine the tourism is directed perhaps more towards Western Europe. Is that where they're looking to grow their economic prosperity from?
Yeah, absolutely. It's Western Europe. They're always, so Saakashvili's very much been sort of cuddling up to Western Europe and the EU, and he wants to sort of push to join NATO very shortly. In terms of tourism at the moment, it's very much neighbour countries, and surprisingly Russia, tourism is huge there. Georgia opened its border to Russia last year again, and Russian tourists are everywhere. Flights are a big problem in terms of gaining a lot of Western tourism. There's a direct flight to Munich and there's one to Istanbul, but really if you want to come from France or Italy or the UK, then you have quite a nightmare journey on your hands, which involves landing after a connection at Tbilisi Airport at about 4 in the morning and leaving at about 5 in the morning. And that's something they're also trying to sort of push through with national carriers in all those countries, is to sort of try and get direct flights, because once you're here, it's actually quite nice.
I was going to say, we're talking generally about tourism, booming hotels. I just wondered what your experience sort of on the ground is. You talk about their pride in welcoming tourists. What have been your experiences? Have they been very pleasant?
Yeah, incredibly pleasant. I mean, you really wouldn't know that there was a civil war here sort of 8 years ago, or 6 years ago, actually. It is incredibly hospitable, and the sort of trust between foreigners and residents is incredible. And small things that when you get into a taxi, there's no taxi meter, which normally you'd think as a tourist is sort of alarm bells sounding. People in the hotels tell you that you should never pay more than 6 lari, which is the local currency, and more often than not, it's sort of 4 lari rather than 6 lari. No matter how long your journey is, if you hand over 4 or 6 lari, then you know the taxi driver is very content just to sort of let you get out of the car. People in the hotels are incredibly friendly. Everybody wants to stop and help you wherever you're going. And sort of Georgian hospitality, which is something that I'd heard about before, but I've never experienced. This is my first time here. It really is one of the country's biggest selling points. It's got an incredible sort of service-orientated culture.
And that was our design editor, Hugo McDonald, chatting to our news editor, Tom Edwards, a little earlier on from Tbilisi in Georgia.
You're listening to Monocle 24. Join us at 2200 hours London time and end the day with the Monocle Daily, live every weekday.
If you're on the go but still want to stay tuned in to Monocle 24, then download the Monocle mobile phone app. You'll have access to our live stream, past shows, Monocle's daily web column, and our 2525 city guides. And it's available for iPhone, Windows Phone 7 and Nokia N9 devices. So take Monocle 24 with you wherever you are, whether you're beachside or airborne. Head to monocle.com for more details.
Welcome back to Midori House. The time is 24 minutes past the hour. Well, a small up-and-coming beer producer from Scotland has publicly attacked the world's biggest distiller, Diageo. It's accused the company of dirty tricks in securing industry awards. A representative from Diageo, who has not been identified, was allegedly overheard at the British Institute of Innkeeping Awards threatening to withdraw the drinks giant sponsorship from future ceremonies if BrewDog, a Arrival was declared the winner. There are claims that the award in question had already been engraved with BrewDog's name, prompting surprise and confusion when a Diageo brand was then declared the winner. Well, earlier Monocle's Christian Yeo spoke to Alex Myers, the director of Manifest, the company which handles BrewDog's PR. He started by asking about Diageo's response to the accusations.
The extent of Diageo's apology proves sort of how big a mistake they made, really. It's quite rare for an organisation of that scale to come out and apologise, I think, in their words, unreservedly to BrewDog for what seemed like quite a basic mistake to make, really. But yeah, David and Goliath is a good way to describe it, really.
Now, in your job as director of PR and handling the PR for this company, it must be either a nightmare or a joy to handle situations like this. It's a great opportunity to have your brand discussed, but also it could go the wrong way. How do you, in terms of damage limitation and you know, profit, monetization and making the best out of this situation, how do you approach it?
Yeah, it's always it's a difficult question, really. I think the question for us was, first of all, about right and wrong, rather than about necessarily a PR opportunity. I think there was an opportunity here to expose a wrongdoing, and we wanted to make the most of that. And obviously, from a press perspective, there's a great media potential. But the story itself wouldn't have been as big if it wasn't for the backlash on Twitter. So it was actually the community of fans around craft beer and around BrewDog on Twitter that was able to escalate this story from being just a small nib that maybe wouldn't have forced an apology from Diageo to being actually a global trend on Twitter, which obviously generates stories in itself.
Let's talk about the support and the response that you've had on Twitter. It's been vast, hasn't it? And it's indicative, really, of where BrewDog has come from in its marketing strategy. It's always had a good presence online, and it's very much aimed at the younger market and the internet generation, but it's taken an old concept and marketed it in a younger way. Has that been its main draw? And in situations like this, is that a very, very, you know, good strength to play on when you've got consumers being able to put their two cents in, when ordinarily you wouldn't have that, you wouldn't have the audience or the customers being able to have their say? These days you can.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the difference between BrewDog and perhaps sort of mainstream beer brands, for example, is we're not looking for necessarily volume in terms of how many people are exposed to the brand. We're looking for passion. I think the guys who established BrewDog want to make everyone as passionate about craft beer as they are. And I think social media is a great way to do that. You've not just got customers, you've got advocates. And if you wrong BrewDog, then you wrong their supporters at the same time. I think everybody felt what Diageo did was wrong, and they wanted to make their feelings clear. And I like the idea of community rather than necessarily just audience. And BrewDog certainly has a community, and they made their voice heard. So certainly the credit for the coverage today, for example, doesn't come from necessarily BrewDog. It comes from the fact that their fans and their community were willing to expose Diageo in the way that they did. And the hashtag "and the winner is not" we became a global trend pretty quickly yesterday, and it's still trending today. So it's interesting to see that that's a capacity for fans to take the stories that they feel are important and bring those to the media. It's a bit of a democratization of the media, if you like.
Absolutely. Going back to the original issue that started all of this, does it raise questions of sponsorship of events like this and the bigger players in the market trying to control the outcome of what are perceived to be fair award shows?
Definitely. I think as a sponsor, you're attaching your name to the eventual winners to some extent. And you should be proud of new up-and-coming businesses within a sector, and obviously helping celebrate best practice, really. I think the idea that sponsorship allows you control is a very old and archaic notion, and something that maybe old and archaic businesses might deem, you know, their position. But I think those sort of businesses aren't going to last very long anymore in a world where, you know, these sort of mistakes don't just get exposed, they get amplified, which is what has been really interesting for me. In the past, perhaps this would have been swept under the carpet and sponsors might have expected this sort of control. That doesn't happen anymore, and certainly not when BrewDog's involved. So it's been very interesting, I think, to see how the concept of the sponsor has shifted. And I, I don't think there's any less value in being a sponsor, but there's certainly more responsibility with it. And yeah, you can't just use your influence in ways, or abuse your influence, if you like, in ways like this and get away with it anymore.
It's quite a brave move by James Watt to speak out against Diageo, but it's not the first time that BrewDog has taken on big issues and had a public spat, essentially.
No, it's definitely not the first time. And certainly James is obviously very opinionated, and it's which is a good thing, because he cares. And I think anyone who cares about an industry or cares about a product and has passion should get that across. But certainly there are other organisations that BrewDog's crossed in the past. So CAMRA, which is the Campaign for Real Ale, have had a lot of debate with BrewDog about the modernisation of the industry, so to speak. The Portman Group, we've got a bit of past with. And yeah, BrewDog don't shy away from controversy. They are somewhat of a maverick brand. And we like it that way. I think obviously the marketing itself sometimes gets criticised because of it. You know, you can, if you give your opinions a voice and certainly try and voice them in as publicly as possible, then often you're holding them up for criticism. But if you care enough, then people will gradually come around to the idea that actually what you're doing is born from passion and not from just headline seeking, really.
You say his actions and his attitude and approach are a good thing, but when you're looking for inward investment and possible acquisition, I don't know what the plan is for BrewDog, but you sort of burn your bridges with companies like Diageo after spats like this, don't you?
You do, but as I said, they're a business born from passion, so investment's a good topic, actually, because I don't think that they would ever, ever look at investment from Diageo or from an organisation that they don't believe does things the right way. And that was proven last year because BrewDog ran something called Equity for Punks, which allowed all of their beer fans to invest in the business. For £95, you could buy 4 shares.
Do you get beer for that? Do you get some
You did get a lifetime discount on beer, yeah. And we found almost 6,000 investors who all invested their own personal money rather than saving in banks and raised £2.2 million. So again, they've taken on the sort of the banks and the financial systems in the past 12 months rather than just the industry.
Alex Myers is the director of the company which handles BrewDog's PR there, talking to Christian Yeo earlier on today. Stay with us here on Midori House, because in the next half hour we'll be asking if you can put a price on the Beatles. And we'll also be talking about the early and rather surprising life of Vidal Sassoon. First of all, though, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the latest news headlines.
Thanks very much, Emma. The former News of the World editor Andy Coulson has today denied he was hired as British Prime Minister David Cameron's media chief because of his ties to News International. Appearing before the Leveson inquiry, Coulson admitted to the inquiry that he had no formal interview. A lawyer for Yulia Tymoshenko and her daughter Yevgenia have said today that they've been refused access to the jailed former Ukraine Prime Minister, who's receiving treatment at a hospital in Kharkiv. The United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon has today strongly condemned 2 suicide car bombings in Syria, which killed 55 people and wounded 372 in Damascus earlier today. European lawmakers have today approved a reform on mobile roaming fees starting on the 1st of July. Charges on calls made while travelling in other European Union countries will no longer exceed 29 cents per minute. A Briton, Jermaine Grant, has appeared in a Kenya court today, accused of links with Somalia's Islamic militants and possessing explosive material with intent to terrorism. And the former model for Levi Jeans and actor Brad Pitt is to become the new face of Chanel No. 5. And those are the stories for the moment here on Monocle 24.
And a very warm welcome back to Midori House. Their music is universally known but seldom heard on the television. Copyright is notoriously strict on material by the Beatles, until it appears now, because Apple Records have given permission for a short burst of Tomorrow Never Knows from Revolver to be played on Mad Men. It's been played in a scene where the ad executive Don Draper is told to listen to Revolver to connect more with youth culture, although apparently he's rather unimpressed. The show's makers have paid $250,000 to play something that thankfully costs we radio people a little less. We'll hear the whole song in just a moment. But to tell us more, I'm joined by Paul Williams, who's head of business analysis at Music Week. A very warm welcome to Midori House, Paul. Just explain to me why the strictness behind the Beatles canon.
The Beatles and their record company, the company that looks after all their affairs, Apple Corp, have always very carefully controlled the way the Beatles' songs and catalogue are exploited. So, you know, up until now, it's unusual. In fact, you know, really not even heard that a Beatles song will end up being used in the show. And in the last few years, the reins have been loosened a little bit. I mean, you end up, you know, hearing Beatles songs turn up in adverts, but they're always cover versions, never the original recording. So the fact that they've allowed not just the Beatles song, but the actual Beatles recording to be used is extremely unusual. So it's, you know, it's quite a bold move and quite an unusual one.
So why do you think Mad Men was the show that broke the ban?
Well, when you talk about the Beatles, you're talking about, you know, arguably the greatest recorded music catalogue that there's ever been. So if it's going to be used in this way, it's going to have to be a special programme. And Mad Men, you know, is regarded as one of the best TV programmes, you know, of the last decade. It's won lots of awards. And apparently, you know, the surviving Beatles and their families are fans of the show. So I think that's probably what swung it.
When you talk about the fact that it's very hard for the Beatles to get played, what effect do you think this has had on preserving the integrity of the Beatles as a work which cannot be touched?
Well, it means that, you know, it hasn't been overexploited, and it's special when the Beatles song does end up in a film or, you know, or on an ad. You know, it doesn't happen all the time. I mean, for example, Beatles songs never end up on compilation albums because, you know, the Beatles always refuse it. The downside, I think, to that is that the Beatles songs then maybe don't reach an audience that don't know them, because, you know, lots of people, you know, of a younger generation, you know, didn't grow up with the Beatles, might stumble across them if they ended up in, you know, songs or movies. And as I say, there has been a bit of a loosening, you know, in recent years. The company that owns their songs, Sony ATV, has started to becoming much more active in the last few years to try and get their songs into adverts, because they realise, you know, if they want a new generation to connect to the Beatles, then the songs need to be exploited and exposed in some kind of way.
Now, much has been made of the fact that the show's makers paid $250,000 to play a clip of Revolver. A, do you think $250,000 is worth it? And B, do you think that now actually puts a value on the Beatles?
Well, it certainly puts a value on the Beatles. Whether it's worth it or not is another matter. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, although it's very much acclaimed because Mad Men is on a TV station in the UK, Sky Atlantic, that doesn't have a big audience. I think something like, you know, only 100,000 people watch Mad Men in the UK. So it would have actually been cheaper for the makers of the programme to buy everybody in the UK watches Mad Men, the download of Tomorrow Never Knows, than it was to pay the $250,000 fee.
I suppose, though, it is fine publicity for Mad Men.
It's great publicity for Mad Men, and obviously not bad publicity for the Beatles, but I don't think suddenly you're going to end up seeing and hearing Beatles songs in every TV show.
Paul, do you think the floodgates theory may well apply here now that one has been given permission, it might be harder for Apple to resist future appeals?
Well, I don't think it's a case that, you know, that suddenly the Beatles songs and recordings are going to be in every TV show or every film, you know. And, you know, but occasionally it happens, and this is, you know, one example. I mean, the Social Network used, I think, Across the Universe in the closing credits of that movie. So it needs to be, you know, a special film or a special TV show for Apple and the Beatles to allow one or more of their songs to be used.
And finally, do you think there are any examples of songs which have been used in the way that this Beatles tune has been used on the television inside a programme which have possibly destroyed the song's reputation as a result?
Well, I can't think of any examples, but I think one of the dangers of, you know, a song being used in an ad or a TV show is that it then becomes, rather than the song and the recording in its own right, it then becomes, oh, that's the song that's the ad for so-and-so, or that's the song that was in that TV programme, and it loses its own identity.
Paul, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That was Paul Williams, Head of Business Analysis at Music Week. Stay with us here on Midori House, because in a moment we'll hear the song we've just been talking about.
Pack your bags and join us on the latest episode of Section D as we head north to tackle Stockholm's ailing architecture landscape. We hit Tel Aviv to hear how it's saving its Bauhaus legacy, And we talk to the photographers of tomorrow at the IER Festival of Fashion and Photography.
I did a poster call on the streets in Bed-Stuy, a neighborhood of Brooklyn in New York, to find someone who never took a photo. And I found a guy called Harrison, and he selected the photos for my photo ceiling installation.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24. Subscribe to Monocle and you'll receive 10 hefty issues and our two seasonal newspapers, delivered anywhere in the world. You'll also receive our special edition canvas tote bag and sometimes even invitations to special events in our key markets. With a variety of subscription options, Monocle is available monthly from £45, and you can also order our special gift package for friends and clients who want to keep an eye on the world. Subscribe today at monocle.com or pop into our shops in Tokyo, Hong Kong, London and New York.
Well, we've just been talking about it, so we may as well play it. This is Tomorrow Never Knows by the Beatles. And that was The Beatles with Tomorrow Never Knows from the Revolver album. Stay with us here on Midori House as we pay tribute to Vidal Sassoon in just a moment. Welcome back. It's 17 minutes to the top of the hour. You're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. Well, as I've just been mentioning, tributes have been paid to Vidal Sassoon, the man credited with liberating women from setting lotion and the crash helmet hairdryer. He died at his home in California earlier this week at the age of 84. But Sassoon had a much more politically engaged side. Born to Jewish parents, it was this heritage which inspired him to be the youngest member of the 43 Group, an anti-fascist organisation which fought against anti-Semitism. Well, to tell me more, I'm very pleased to say I'm joined in the studio by Julian Vogel, who made a film of Sassoon's life and as a result ended up being his PR for 5 years until his death. A very warm welcome to Midori House, Julian. Lovely to see you.
Thank you very much.
Let's go to the beginnings of this. Tell us what the 43 Group was all about.
Well, I think you have to take your mind back. So there was a group of Jews who fought during the war. They fought for the British Army, the British Navy. They came out and actually when they went home, they found that there was still a lot of anti-Semitism around. And Mosley was starting to gain quite a big following. So a guy called Morris Beckman got together 43 ex-servicemen and women, and between them they had this incredible number of military crosses and Victoria crosses, and they got together in secret and they decided they were going to do something about it.
So Sassoon obviously was far too young to be engaged in this during the war, because he was sent out of London,
yeah,
wasn't he, and sent to a Jewish orphanage. So how did he get involved in it?
I think that at this time he was back in London. He was in the East End, and through various friends he heard that this was happening, and he was very keen to get involved. And I think that's definitely something that he always seems to have been keen to get involved and get into the thick of things, and he was never frightened of standing up for things that he believed in.
And when you say he got into the thick of things, did this actually involve taking fascists to task?
I mean, yeah, he tells a great story of at this time he was a hairdresser, so he was in a salon in the West End, and he turned up one day with a black eye. And this very, this very sort of, sort of well-to-do lady said, "Oh, Vidal, what happened?" And he just looked at her deadpan and said, "Oh, don't worry, madam, I just tripped over a hairpin." And I think that, again, it shows that he didn't want to really engage. I think they were also told that what they were doing, they needed to keep secret. It wasn't something to be talked about. And he just wanted to get on with it. But yeah, they, you know, he tells stories of them literally brawling in the streets and really, you know, finding out where the black shirts were going to be and taking them to task. And, you know, I think they were quite a formidable force.
You say that, you know, they obviously had to keep it quiet. How long was it before he actually started to talk about it?
I don't know, because I met him properly about 5 years ago. And you know, through the course of the film, I think by that point it was out in the open. There'd been documentaries. There were a lot of documentaries about looking back at what had happened in those times. And I think there was a lot more research was being done. And I think that at that point he felt that it was, you know, that it was appropriate to talk about it. And also I think he felt that there was a lot of other things going on now that, you know, whether it's religious causes or I think he felt that. There wasn't so much fascism, but there were issues that were going on now that this had sort of parallels with.
Was it something that he ever managed to combine? Because, I mean, at one time he was known as the anti-fascist hairdresser, so he was publicly seen as being able to play both roles. But how closely did he combine the two exercises?
I think, I mean, we spent a lot of time together and did a lot of interviews together, and he'd quite often get onto the subject of politics. I think that, you know, he didn't have a particularly good formal education, but he was certainly somebody that was a real, you know, he constantly strived to educate himself. He was very interested in philosophy. He would sort of, you know, I saw him in February, and, you know, he wasn't very well. I mean, but he was still reading. I think he was reading War and Peace at the time. You know, he was always striving. And I think that, you know, I think that I wouldn't say that in his hairdressing he was, you know, there was a strong political message, but, you know, he could really have been anything. I mean, the fact that he was a hairdresser, but, you know, whatever he did, he wanted to change, and he wanted to change an industry. He wanted to change the way things were done. He wanted to change the way things were looked at. He wasn't happy with it, just the status quo.
And you said obviously that he would talk about it in interviews. Did he maintain his sort of political outspokenness throughout his life?
I think one of the issues that I think followed him through his life was the anti-Semitism. I think he came across so much when he was growing up. And then in 1982, he actually formed the Vidal Sassoon International Centre for the Study of Anti-Semitism. And he actually talked about anti-Semitism in philosophical terms and talked about ingrained anti-Semitism and, you know, different classifications of it. And I think that that was something that he grew up with. And I think that, you know, that was something that he was incredibly passionate about stamping out. And I think the Mosley thing was one issue. Fighting in Palestine was another issue because, you know, in 1948, you know, the United Nations was formed and the Brits moved out of Palestine. And, you know, he was very concerned that the Jews had a home and had somewhere that they could call home. And I think that came from the anti-Semitism, that came from the fact that he went into the army, as he went to do national service. He found an incredible amount of anti-Semitism, even though we'd just come out of a war, you know, and we just fought against Hitler and fought against all of those issues. It was still very ingrained. And I think that, you know, that was something very important to him.
It mattered so much to him immediately after the war that didn't he go and join up the Israeli Defence
Force?
Yeah,
and he didn't just join the Israeli Defence Force. He actually joined this crack team called the Palmach. And they were the kind of, you know, they were the elite of the elite. And, you know, and in his biography and in the film, he talks a lot about, you know, the stories of what happened. And, you know, I can't imagine it. You know, he talks about fighting the Egyptians. I mean, you can't imagine now, you know, somebody talking about fighting in those terms.
Well, especially Vidal Sassoon, who's known to be a sort of a cheerful, happy, you know, gentle character.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing was that he was, you know, in those days he'd gone through national service. He was incredibly fit, and that's something else that followed him all his life. You know, he was this kind of, in the film they call him, one of the characters calls him a keep fit superhero. You know, he was into Pilates and way before anyone had even heard of it, and he ate really healthily. And, you know, so I think, again, you know, these disciplines, I think for him it was a lot of it was about discipline.
I mean, you work with him very, very closely. When you talk about these disciplines and this political activism, how did that actually come out in his work?
I think that it was interesting for me talking to people that had worked for him, because they did describe him as a complete tyrant. But, you know, so it was interesting how he was so fastidious, and he would send people home if their shoes weren't polished. You know, he just felt that everything had to be just right and everything was important. And so for me, it was interesting because I didn't see so much of that side of things, because, you know, he was a bit, he'd mellowed a bit. But, you know, when we went to do interviews, you know, he'd had 200 episodes of his own TV show. So he knew what an editor needed or a producer needed. So you'd sit there and I'd just marvel at his ability to, you know, come up with a soundbite, come up with the, you know, we were doing a TV show and, you know, you could see the crew were winding up the show, and he came up with just the perfect, you know, I think the interviewer said, you know, what advice do you have for young hairdressers? And you could see it was like there was 10 seconds left, and he just looked at the camera and said, you know, don't sleep with the clients. You know, which is just, it's just a genius, you know, genius soundbite that that, you know, only a master could really, you know, master of media could really, really come up with.
Julian, thank you very much indeed for joining us. That was Julian Vogel, filmmaker and former PR of Vidal Sassoon. The time is 8 minutes towards the top of the hour. This is Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 highlight, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ja jokso.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljat. Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Afto je to Monocle 24.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
7 minutes to the top of the hour here. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Well, one could argue that higher education is losing its edge, that you can sign up to do a course in pretty much anything nowadays. One could also argue that the world's oldest profession needs no formal training, as it's always been a growth area. However, a Spanish company has created a course on prostitution. It guarantees a job on graduation, it says. Content includes learning the ins and outs of the trade. My thanks to my producer, Danny Giacopelli, for that particular line. Well, to tell us more about all this, here on the line to talk about it is in Madrid, is Liam Aldous. Liam, I was lost for words by that, frankly. So why have they put this course together? Just take me through it.
Well, I'm just still appreciating Vidal Sassoon's segue of don't sleep with the clients. And now we're talking about a course which encourages people to sleep with their clients. I thought that was great. thank you, Daniel. But so basically the course involves a lot of, there's quite a selective criteria or curriculum, if you will. It talks about the history of prostitution. So there is a bit of theoretical knowledge. It's not all straight into the practical side of things. It also puts the history of prostitution in the context of its place in the world and how attitudes have evolved, its place in Spain, and then it goes into the financial aspect of the profession, how to manage your earnings. There's quite a steady inflow of cash, so you need to know how to invest, obviously. And then talks about the legislation in Spain, how to obviously maneuver your way around the legislation, I'm assuming. And then apart from the practical aspects, which I'll get to, they also study a bit of the prostitute's Bible, the Kama Sutra book, apparently.
Right. And who's on this? I'm assuming, is this clients or workers in it? And if so, do you need to sort of pass any exams to get on it?
Well, apparently they were apparently fielding people, applicants around universities, or handing out flyers. So, I mean, while it may sound like a professional operation, it seems to me a bit of an ad hoc scheme, if you will. I think the crisis is bringing out the best and strangest and funniest elements of every society, especially in Spain. And, I mean, the man who was interviewed on the news, who was the public face of this company, looked like he was an immigrant. He looked like he was South American. He was in his 20s. He was wearing a beautiful love heart pattern tie as well. It doesn't seem like it's a professional course, but I think it's someone trying to take advantage of the economic situation. And apparently they've had six applicants formally sign up, or six who are willing to admit to it. So, I mean, it is gaining traction. It's a new story, and I'm sure with the coverage, they're going to get a lot more people signing up.
I mean, you mentioned the gentle manoeuvring around the law. I mean, prostitution, I take it, is illegal in Spain, but I must assume that it is tolerated because of this course.
Well, it's kind of a bit of a vacuum, really. The brothels have been illegal since 1956, and street prostitution is illegal, but the police seem to turn a blind eye to it. There are still a lot of brothels. They may be technically illegal, but they're usually called clubs or whiskerias, which is a whiskey bar, I think, but it sounds like a delightful little prostitution spot, a whiskeria. But the strange and stark thing is, if you come to Madrid and also in Barcelona and along a lot of the highways, you see a lot of prostitutes in the plain light of day along the streets. So sometimes it's quite an interesting image to see police stand right next to a bunch of prostitutes in the middle of the day. And I think this kind of highlights the different attitudes towards prostitution, if anything, between Anglo-Saxon countries, for example. I'm from Australia. And in Spain, when I moved back to Spain, I found it quite a confronting image, just to have prostitutes air kissing me and walking alongside me and soliciting me, I think. But I think it's just everywhere. And I think one thing about Spain is that things like this, especially sex, is quite out in the open. It's not hidden and it's not undercover. So this is one thing that you notice when you come to Spain.
So what's the media reaction been to this? Because obviously the gentleman who's running this course, like you say, has been applying his wares on the telly.
Well, it's been a sensational news item. A lot of people have heard about it. It's one of the typical news items that comes up that gets the office talking. And I mean, on the televised news, they had a lot of people, reporters doing vox pops, and everyone they interviewed was disgusted and thought it was quite tacky and I was giving a bad image to Spain. But I mean, the prostitutes on the street also are quite a confronting image. So I mean, it's not just these small people trying to turn into a business that are giving a bad image. I think it's just I mean, there's another story in Barcelona. They tried to make the prostitutes wear reflective vests along the highways because they were obviously causing a bit of a hazard, and some of them were getting hit by cars. So to make them more visible for motorists, they made them wear reflective vests, which was quite interesting.
Liam, thank you very much indeed. My only question that I haven't afraid got time to ask is, can you get sponsored by the EU?